I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and as you've undoubtedly heard, this is a big day for retailers hanging out sale signs. And we want to spend some time today talking about what journalist Ellen Ruppelschell calls our Faustian pact with bargains. She says it contributes to the blighted landscape, the financial crisis, and the devaluing of the worker and the things they used to craft. Such a deal. Ellen is a professor of science journalism at Boston University. Her latest book is Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
This is a tough sell, but you know that better than anybody. You are a bargain hunter.
Well, I was a bargain hunter, and now I'm older and wiser thanks to the research for this book.
But you bought the watch from the street vendors. You bought the, well, what else? What'd you buy?
Well, I begin by talking about what I call the boot incident. I was preparing to go out for a New Year's Eve party, and the day before, I decided I needed a new pair of boots. As psychologists say, actually I learned this as a term of art in psychology, I am deal prone, or at least I was deal prone. I really, really liked getting bargains. I actually sought them out. So in any case, I was out at my local shoe store looking for a new pair of boots, and I tried one after another, and none of them were really that great. I mean, they didn't fit that well, they didn't look that good. And finally, I asked the owner of the store, look, can you get me a little classier boots, you know, something that would be a little more festive for the occasion? So he went to the back of the store and he brought me two pairs that were much more attractive than the other ones. I tried them on, and one pair in particular were just beautiful. The leather was luscious. The fit was perfect.
How much were they?
Well, sticker shock. I took one look. They were over $400. I said, you know what? I'm deal prone. I understand that now. I'm not going to buy these boots. So I bought a pair of the cheap boots, wore them the next night to the party. They were just as clunky as I thought they would be. And the next morning after the party, I threw them in the back of my closet and noticed that they were on top of what I call my pile of shame. All these garments, you know, belts, hats, boots that I've worn once and in some cases not at all. One thing that they had in common were that they were all either on sale or deep discount or very, very inexpensive.
And there's a chance that if you'd bought that really nice pair of boots, now, I have to say over 400, that's a bit steep, but 200,
yes.
You know, if you had bought a really nice pair of boots, you'd still be wearing them today.
Well, there are two things, Robin, that I think that incident showed me. One is that they were a high price boot, and they were probably more than I would even pay today, which pointed out to me how we've got this bifurcated system now with some very, very high cost goods and many, many low cost goods. What's gone is that kind of medium, that middle priced good, as you say, you know, $150, $180 pair of boots maybe, that might be a stretch for many of us, but we know are going to last a long time and work for us.
Well, and be the equivalent of five pairs of cheap boots that you end up getting.
Absolutely,
well,
absolutely.
Now, I want to rush to say we are not talking about people who absolutely cannot afford not just Italian boots, but any who are pinching pennies, who are desperately, you know, trying to survive here. You're talking about people who are shoppers who have discretionary income, but do what? Think what?
Well, first of all, I think I am talking a much wider range of people. Going around the country, having spoken about this book, I've talked to people from all different backgrounds, socioeconomic levels, and many of them have found themselves in that same situation that I found myself in. That is that they found themselves paying again and again for things that they thought were great deals and, in fact, did not serve them right. Because, you know, when you think about it, if you wear something once, the price per wear is astronomical. If it's a $50 pair of boots, that's $50 for that one time you wore it. If you don't wear it at all, and many of us have had the experience of going to the store, buying something, getting it because it's such a great deal, bringing it home and not being happy with it, the price is actually infinite. The price per wear is actually infinite mathematically. So, in fact, it's not just people who are affluent who are in this category. I found actually people very enthusiastic about this concept who are working class or even people who are struggling just to make their weekly nut. Okay, so it's not just affluent folks that are in this category.
And I didn't mean affluent. I meant, you know, at least having some discretionary income. But I take your point. So it comes to your research. Why do we do it? You went to a conference on behavior pricing, one of the many areas that you look to get some answers. You learn what happens to the mind when we're confronted with discounts. What does happen?
one of the things that this book introduced me to was the whole notion of pricing science, that there are psychologists and business experts and economists who actually specialize in setting prices. And then there's a subgroup in that category who specialize in setting markdowns. And a lot of this is predicated on mathematical formula and things like this. But a big part of the whole pricing gambit is understanding the psychology of price. Now, many of us think of price as a number, you know, just a number. And a number seems objective. You know, it seems like the most objective thing you could know about a product. In fact, sometimes it's the only thing you know about a product. Mm. You don't know where the thing is made. You don't know who made it. You don't sometimes even know what it's made of, but you know the price. But in fact, what these pricing scientists know is that there's nothing more emotional than a price. And if you think about it, if you've bought something and a friend of yours has gotten it much cheaper, that really makes you angry or disappointed. But if you bought the same thing and your friend paid more for it, it gets you pretty excited. You feel pretty smart. Prices evoke a very strong emotional response in all of us. And retailers know that this emotional response can sometimes dampen our rational thinking process.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with journalist Ellen Ruppel-Shell. Her new book is Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. She goes deep into the research. Here's some more of what she learned at that behavioral pricing conference at Fordham University. Those 9 for the price of 10 punch cards you get at places like Starbucks, they really do make people buy a coffee they weren't going to buy just to get one free. So-called exploding discounts, buy now before they go, are meant to make us think in the present instead of in the future. And if we think down the line, we might realize we can't afford that purchase. Ellen, some of these, you know, we're smart enough to know that we know something at $9.99 sounds so much better than something at $10. But you met a Stanford neuroscientist, Brian Knutson. He watched consumers' brain scans while they looked at products and prices on a computer. When a price was excessive, the part of their brain that's associated with guilt and pride lit up. When a discount showed up on the screen, another part of their brain associated with gains and losses lit up. And he could ultimately tell by watching the brain scan when they would plan to buy, because a sale sign reframed a loss of money as a gain?
Absolutely. The anticipation of getting a discount, not actually getting the discount. And that's what's so interesting. We talk about 99 cents, for example. Well, we think we're all wise to that trick. But in fact, psychologists told me that even people who specialize in pricing psychology can be vulnerable to this 99-cent symbol, mm-hmm. because what it signifies to us is a deal. That sparks the part of our brain that is less rational, more impulsive, that is the game-playing part of the brain. You want to win that game as quickly as possible, and you do it by getting the lowest possible price.
But once you've done that, something fascinating happens. There's sort of a psychological rejection of the cheap once you've bought it. You talk about studies where when people are given an energy drink or a painkiller and told it was cheaper than another, and in fact they're exactly the same, but when these college students were told it was cheaper, they actually had less impact from the thing.
Right. That work was done by Dan Ariely, who, you know, was both a psychologist and a business expert. He showed that college students who were given a painkiller, for example, that was discounted, did not have the same reaction to it as if they thought they'd paid full price. In other words, it didn't work as well. So while the transaction of a deep discount is a thrill in our brain, the actual product is devalued as soon as we bring it home. And that's why many of us find ourselves not taking that good care of things that we've bought at deep discount. And you have to understand that discounting is a relatively new phenomenon.
Well, tell us about this. We have this love-hate relationship with the cheap. There was a time when quality was king. Our grandmothers would say, buy one good thing once, you know, have it for the rest of your life. When did that change?
Well, actually, the evolution of this traces all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, before we could mass manufacture things, nothing was cheap. The process of mass manufacture that happened in the 18th and the 19th century is what made it possible for us to make consumer goods cheaply. And by the turn of the last century, about 50% of goods in the United States were mass manufactured, and that allowed us to start this discounting process. And there's a whole history to that with John Wanamaker, Frank Woolworth, other retailing giants that we've heard of, the invention of the price tag, for example. Before we had a price tag, we couldn't really discount. That wasn't until almost the turn of the last century that the price tag was invented. But actual discounting that we think of today, 1955, only about 5% of goods in department stores were sold at a discount. By 1995, 80% of goods in department stores were sold at a discount. So that just shows you what a radical change occurred in the 80s and 90s, and this tendency, this demand for discounted goods. And today, about 33% of all consumer goods are sold at discount.
Well, let's go back to the evolution. Some would say, what's wrong with that? You know, post the Industrial Revolution, people could have things that were previously out of their reach. That's good.
Sure. And the John Wanamaker way was a good way. He was a very religious man. He said that all men should be equal before God and also equal before price. And he tried to make consumer goods accessible to as many people as possible, which is why he invented the sale. However, this has become distorted. And I talk about the Woolworth model. Woolworth scoured the globe for as cheap goods as possible, and he wrote a letter home from Europe talking about how he had found these very cheap thermometers. And he actually wrote this: these thermometers aren't very good, they don't work very well, but they're so cheap, I know Americans will buy them. And what also allowed Woolworth to sell as cheaply as he did is he paid his workers so poorly, his clerks, so poorly that they could not even afford to live on their own. They had to live at home with their parents. We've kind of gone over to this Woolworth model, not the Wanamaker model, where he worked hard to provide quality goods at a reasonable price and also supported his staff. It was more the Woolworth model, where he scours the globe for things that are made as cheaply as possible that may or may not be of decent quality, and as well pushes down the wages and benefits to his workers to get himself tremendous profits. It's not as if all those savings were passed on to consumers. No, Woolworth became an extremely wealthy man.
You quote President William McKinley over a century ago saying, cheap merchandise means cheap men. There was a sense that predatory pricing was bad for workers, bad for Americans, bad for merchants. Then suddenly got flipped, and it's good. Now, I want to rush to say, you point to some discounters that you think still uphold the Wanamaker values. Am I right in saying Costco? You think that Costco...
I say they do a better job. It doesn't have to be quite the way it's gone. Costco certainly supports its workers. It pays fair wages. It doesn't offer the selection of some of the other discount stores, and they are quite upfront about that. So I don't say that this is a situation that cannot be dealt with. It definitely can be dealt with. There are also some mid-price retailers that I talk about that work assiduously to offer quality at a reasonable price. In other words, they offer value rather than this race to the bottom.
Ellen Ruppelshell's new book is Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. She'll be right back. Later, those White House party crashers, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Ellen Ruppelshell, professor of science journalism at Boston University and author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Ellen, I am guilty as charged. I fish Bed Bath & Beyond coupons out of my neighbor's recycling bins. But tell us what you see as the side effects of, you know, Americans wanting a lower price.
Well, you know, I think I traced this story all the way back to China. I look at the consequences for the people in China, but I talk about how this is a double-edged sword, how the so-called China price, which of course is the lowest possible price that we're willing to pay suppliers in China, these prices are often imposed not by the Chinese themselves, but by multinationals or American companies that are demanding these very, very low prices. It's not just in China. It's in other countries in the developing world. And in fact, you know, if there's dissent and the prices go up there, American multinational companies are just happy to move elsewhere, perhaps Vietnam, even Africa. There's discussion of that, to go to the places where rule of law is not necessarily enforced, either in, around human rights issues or around environmental issues. When I say it's a double-edged sword, I say it has come back to haunt us, because where the price of consumer goods have gone down, down, down in the last 30 years, the price of things that we can't live without, whether it's housing or health care or other essentials, child care, have gone up. So our wages and benefits have gone down, or at best remained stagnant for 90% of Americans. We're able to buy some of these cheap, cheap consumer goods, but look at the price we've paid for that.
But staying with the human rights impact of low prices in the U.S. on workers around the world, there are people who say, aren't workers in a sweatshop better off than not having any income at all? You say no.
You know, having seen those conditions in the developing world, I can say that it's an easy out for us, but it's not probably the way we want to go. I think that we certainly cannot level the playing field, but we can require the suppliers in those countries to provide at least the minimum benefit and wage and human rights protections that we would expect of anyone we did business with in this country. I think it's a cynical and very sad idea that we need to impose these conditions on the developing world simply to get goods for ourselves. And I think there are also a lot of misunderstandings about what has elevated people in the developing world. For example, in China, agrarian reforms did much to elevate the conditions in China well before the sweatshops brought them income. So I think that is simplistic, and it's kind of an easy way out for us, but not one we really should strive for.
Other issues, when you're throwing cheap stuff away, it's bad for the environment. And also, speaking of bad for the environment, who hasn't done this? When you get in your car and drive, you know, however many miles for a $5 coupon, you know,
right,
what are you doing? So sometimes we expend so much energy for the cheap that adds up too.
So many of these discounters actually externalize their real costs. So whether it's you're being forced to drive 50 miles round trip, and the cost of your time, which we discount radically, the cost of the pollution or the literal cost of the gas involved in these trips, these kind of externalized costs, I encourage people to add into their calculations when they think of how so-called cheap these things really are.
You list so many things that we've demanded are cheaper, and so they are, and the quality has plummeted. Shrimp.
Right. One of the food examples I use is shrimp. You know, shrimp used to be a delicacy for many of us. Shrimp now is more popular in the United States than tuna fish. Aquaculture has made this possible, that is, the farming of shrimp in ponds. I talk about the situation in Thailand and other parts of East Asia where these ponds are polluted. They've led to environmental degradation, extensive human rights violations. Also that, in one case I found, a customer getting 200 shrimp at a Red Lobster restaurant at one go for $16. And I sort of raised the question, gee, is it really a good thing to be robbing these people of their environment, their livelihood, stability, all sorts of things in the developing world so we can have shrimp that, you know, we can get 200 in a restaurant for less than $16? And it's kind of making that calculation, the quality calculation versus the price to determine value. The book is kind of a call for return to really considering value. It's not at all about being extravagant. And at the end of the book, I talk about frugalism and the importance of frugalism, really understanding what we're getting when we make purchases.
But just speak to the person who might say, I am being frugal. I'm going to go to IKEA and get my beautifully designed, nice piece that looks almost like something that's been handcrafted, and I spend a lot less. I'm being frugal.
Right. And IKEA is a great example. I did go to IKEA in Sweden. I visited both the design and the international headquarters there. You have to understand that the founding director of IKEA is one of the five richest men in the world, and there's a reason for that. He wants you to be frugal, so he need not be frugal. So when you buy, for example, a night table at IKEA that will cost typically $59.99, and there's that 99 cents again, what is that night table made of? Veneer and cardboard. if you're aware of that, that it's not a hardwood table, that it's not even a softwood table, if you're aware of what you're getting, if you're aware that this is probably a disposable object in some cases at IKEA, how long are you going to have it? What is its cost per use? And that's what we really have to figure out. Not will it be good for us now, but will we be able to resell it on Craigslist? Will it retain its value? And I give an example of the book, in the book, for example, of getting a very good used bookcase versus an IKEA bookcase, one that can really stand up to time. And I actually own one of these bookcases. I'm sure many of your listeners do. It stood up to time. It's done a good job. I can either give it to my kids. I could sell it on Craigslist if I move. In terms of the environmental and human rights issues, they don't exist. It's not an either or. It's not expensive or the cheapest possible thing. There's that happy middle ground that's gotten squeezed out because there are such big profits to be made in discounting. We think when we're getting these great deals that we're so clever, we're so smart, we forget that someone is profiting, some group is profiting tremendously from these deep discounts.
And they have little marionette strings attached to your back while you're doing it.
Right, right.
Ellen Ruppel Schell is a professor of science journalism at Boston University. Her latest book is Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Think of it when you go out to shop. No, maybe read it before you go out to shop. Ellen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Monday on Here and Now, David Leonhardt on how to follow the healthcare reform debate. That's Monday. The very latest news in just a couple minutes, Here and Now. Dubai is shaking up world markets today and not in the way it hoped to. You've probably seen images of Dubai lately as it tries to reinvent itself with a building boom, an indoor ski slope, hundreds of man-made islands, the world's tallest skyscraper, 200 stories. But is that boom bust because of the credit crisis that's taken the wind out of a lot of sails? Dubai's main investment arm, called Dubai World, wants to delay repaying nearly $60 billion in the debt that financed that boom. The New York Times compares that to a homeowner asking a mortgage holder to allow 6 months of skipped mortgage payments. The BBC's business correspondent Mark Gregory has been following this story. Mark, first of all, tell us more about Dubai World.
Dubai World is a real estate company controlled by the Dubai government, and the Dubai World was actually responsible for some of the largest real estate developments, and so of course has got some of the largest debt. Now, it had been quite sort of assumed that because Dubai was part of the United Arab Emirates, and Abu Dhabi in particular is extremely wealthy with all that oil wealth, that actually its Gulf neighbours would make sure that Dubai's problems never got to the point where it really hit the public gaze. But then on Thursday came the shock announcement that Dubai World wanted to delay repaying its debts, and that sparked fears that Dubai as a whole, the whole state, could default on its debts, sparking fears really of a kind of a Middle East equivalent of the subprime meltdown that you had in the US.
What would that mean if, in fact, Dubai, the biggest economic engine in Dubai, is the oil industry? You know, what would it mean if that country starts to falter financially? Do people have other sources of income?
Dubai's problems have been around for some time now, and of course Dubai, its huge property boom, most of these buildings were built by migrant workers from South Asia. Lots of them, millions of them, have already been sent back home, so people have already been suffering. The problems of Dubai's property market have been known for quite some time. What's new, if you like, is the scale of the financial problem. But it was always assumed that the rest of the Gulf, which of course has got lots of money, would step in and bail Dubai out. On Thursday, that became much less clear.
Yeah. And by the way, when Dubai says it wants its loan holders to wait 6 months, who are they?
A lot of the world's major financial institutions in one way or another. The most exposed are, in fact, European banks. Indeed, I've seen some figures today suggesting that the total exposure of European banks to the United Arab Emirates, which contains Dubai, is as much as $90 billion, and half of that is British banks. But there's also significant exposure for banks in Asia and, indeed, the United States.
And so what is the sense going forward of what the next chapter in this story is?
Well, actually, the latest feeling is that this may have been more of a bungled public relations announcement than the onset of a real crisis. It still seems very, very unlikely that the Gulf states would allow Dubai to default. So some signs that the crisis has eased. And actually, on global markets, there was initially a huge shock on Thursday, particularly in Europe. But now that mood of crisis is actually receding a bit, and Wall Street opened a little bit lower. But that appears to be reacting to Thursday's events rather than any new momentum to that, because, of course, Wall Street was closed on Thursday for the Thanksgiving holiday.
So you say that this might have been just a bungled announcement, but what further are you saying? So Dubai isn't in as much financial trouble?
No, Dubai is in a lot of financial trouble, that's quite clear. But it still seems the case that actually, because it's surrounded by wealthy neighbours and indeed has some of its own resources, that it's a containable crisis within the Middle East. But of course, what set the markets off was not so much Dubai itself as Dubai, but the fear that it could spark another global cycle of financial market chaos. It could be, if you like, the trigger for something much bigger. So what in a sense has receded is not the sense that Dubai has a crisis, but there's now a feeling that Dubai's neighbours will help it deal with that, but there's also a sense that actually Dubai is unlikely to be the trigger, at least not at the moment, for some kind of global renewed financial meltdown.
Mark Gregory, the BBC's business correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, you're up to date on that. And just a reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also refer back to past shows. You can download a podcast, take us with you, leave a comment there, or click on Contact Us to send an email. We'd love to hear from you, hereandnow.org. Coming up, fame or felony conviction, back in 30 seconds, with a look at those White House party crashers, Here and Now. Welcome back.
Mr. and Mrs. Salahi.
That's Tarek and Michaela Salahi being announced at the White House state dinner Tuesday night, and as we now know, they were not invited. The Northern Virginia couple may be the most famous party crashers in the world, but will that stunt bring them the fame they craved? The Bravo Network has been filming Michaela Salahi as part of the audition process for the upcoming Real Housewives of Washington, D.C. reality series. But today, the Secret Service said it may open a criminal investigation. Roxanne Roberts of the Washington Post broke this story. Roxanne, the couple's lawyer says the White House cleared them for that party. The White House says they weren't invited. What's the latest?
Well, the lawyer is parsing. The White House did clear them, meaning that the Secret Service cleared them to walk into the White House. That doesn't mean they were invited to be there. They certainly were not seated at the dinner, and they were not on the guest list.
Well, we rush to say, as the White House has said to you and others, that they had to go through metal screeners, as everyone else did, so there's the feeling that there wasn't that much of a danger, although we're thinking, you know, you could just throw a glass at the president, you know, if you wanted to. It seems like it's still is this still being considered a huge transgression?
It is a huge transgression, and the reason it's a huge transgression is that the White House is contending right now that these two people managed to walk up to the door and basically bluff their way inside. Now, they had to have provided identification. They did go through magnetometers, but they were standing next to Rahm Emanuel. They were standing and photographed next to Joe Biden. Technically, they could have done almost anything. The issue is whether or not how close they got to the president and prime minister. And right now we're trying to determine, we don't know yet, and the White House obviously is not thrilled to share this information, whether or not they went through the receiving line before dinner, which would have had them right next to the first family and the prime minister. The White House is saying these people effectively bluffed their way in because there was a breakdown in a checkpoint.
Astonishing.
Astonishing. Astonishing, and that's what makes it. I mean, if you had crashed any place else, everyone would go, oh, you know, great party crash. This is the White House. Yeah. It's completely different from any other party, any other place. Yeah. So they're liable for some sort of felony charges if they lied to a federal official. You can't let two people get into the White House without some consequences.
We know that Tarek Salahi is from a wealthy wine family. The couple apparently has a horse farm. Have you learned anything new about them? Who are they?
Well, I can tell you they're not wealthy.
Ah.
As a matter of fact, there's a question of how much in debt they are. They're not horse people. They do play polo. But part of this elaborate facade is to make them look more important and more influential than they are. These are social climbers, pure and simple. Here's a perfect example of exactly how shameless they are. Hours after the concert at the Lincoln Memorial during inaugural weekend, many hours afterward, when that place had been cleared off and was not going to be used again, so it didn't have to be secured, they sat in the box that the president had sat in many hours later and had a picture of themselves in that box. And then on their Facebook account, they said, "We were so honored to be invited to be in the president's box." It's the kind of shamelessness. I mean, I know they're not embarrassed, but I am embarrassed for them.
Well, and Roxanne, one last question. We know the Bravo Network was filming them because, the wife is auditioning to be on this TV show.
Right.
They say they had no idea. They thought for sure the couple was invited. Any sense of whether or not this couple actually is going to be going on to a reality show? We know the Balloon Boy parents saw their reality TV show hopes fade after their scam was revealed.
Question is really, are they going to be charged criminally for this? Personally, it would break my heart if they end up rich and famous because they pulled off this stunt. I would feel terrible because I think it's really crossed the line in terms of reality shows and reality behavior. This is a lack of respect for the presidency. It's a lack of respect for protocol. It's a lack of respect for the law.
That's Roxanne Roberts of The Washington Post, also, of course, of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thanks so much for speaking to us.
You're more than welcome.
Well, it's a day of leftover turkey, but there's still plenty of fresh football. And joining us to talk about some of the big games, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, a belated happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, Robin, and same to you.
Yeah, and let's start with college football. Big game today, Pitt's Alabama, number two. I wish we had some marching music here. Depending on what poll you read, they're number two or three against Auburn. Is this just another game along Alabama's march to a possible national championship game?
Well, you can throw out the record book when these teams play each other. These two teams don't like each other. Both teams will come to play, and footballs bounce funny because they aren't round. Is that enough cliches? Okay. Alabama is, as you say, number two or number three. I look down my list of ESPN BCS football rankings, and I find Auburn is, oops, not in the top 25.
Yeah.
I like Alabama.
There you go. Well, upsets can happen. Number six, Boise State plays its final home game of the season tonight when Nevada comes calling and riding an eight-game winning streak.
That's a nice metaphor. They knock quietly at the door.
Well, does Nevada, you know, they have some momentum enough to pull off an upset there?
Nevada has three guys who've rushed for over 1,000 yards. Boise State has a quarterback who's thrown for 33 touchdowns. How do you like the odds that this one ends 3-0? I have no idea. That's why they play them.
Okay. Well, we can't leave college football without mentioning what happened in a game we talked about on yesterday's program, that being the Turkey Day Classic between Tuskegee and Alabama State University. Yesterday, we wanted to let everyone know Tuskegee got some revenge. They lost last year's game. It was a big upset there. But they shut out the Alabama State Hornets 21-0. Their defense dominated the game, gave up just
51 yards.
In offense to the Hornets. So there's that. I also want to mention one other thing. I don't know if you watched any high school games, the most fun games of all, but I just want to send a shout out to the 0-10 Cambridge Ringe and Latin Falcons, who, how did the Globe put it here, got steamrolled by the Everett, also called the Everett Crimson Tide. Everett High School beat them. And I just want to say to the Falcons, they've got their quarterback, Johnny, on the sidelines with a broken arm, my nephew with a broken collarbone, and they have a lot of heart. So can we just say that? They had a lot of bad breaks.
May they survive into healthy old age.
Bringing us to one last topic, pro football. This week, the National Football League announced the co-chair of its committee on brain injuries has resigned. Is this a sign they've finally gotten...
This is important because Ira Kaysen, one of the guys who resigned, is the fellow who had said there was no connection between multiple concussions and brain injuries. Beyond that, the NFL has said that independent doctors not working for teams will be welcome now, in fact, to examine players. This is a big step, potentially.
Okay, probably something you'll be talking about. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program. Don't miss it. Only a game. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Quick news note, we're hearing for the first time what happened in the air when Northwest Flight 188 overflew its destination by 150 miles last month. The FAA released transcripts and audio recordings between air traffic controllers and the pilots today. The pilots were out of contact with controllers for 77 minutes, you'll remember, and when they got back in communication, the controllers asked if the cockpit was secure. The pilots responded it was secure and they'd been distracted. Here are a few clips we've edited them together, where the air traffic controllers asked the pilots what happened. The pilots keep saying it was a cockpit distraction.
Northwest 188, we are now in communications with, and they're on a 135 heading. Northwest 188, do you have time to give a brief explanation on what happened?
Just cockpit distraction, that's all I can say.
Northwest 188, Roger.
Well, the pilots told the National Transportation Safety Board they'd been discussing their company's complicated new crew scheduling program over their laptop computers. They were both suspended by Delta Northwest Airlines, and the FAA revoked their licenses, the pilots appealing that decision. Question for you. What do you picture when you hear this music? Well, here's what Sean Day pictures.
I see in front of me a large cloud of sky blue mist. There's billowing as the music grows louder and it goes to the background as the music goes softer.
Sean Day has synesthesia, a neurological condition that causes senses to conflate. In this case, when Sean listens to music, he also sees colors. It can happen as well when he tastes or smells something. It's fascinating. So today we want to revisit a conversation we had with a researcher who studies synesthesia and with Sean, who's president of the American Synesthesia Association. We asked him when he first became aware that he had it.
I've had it since as long as I can remember. I know that I was playing around with it when I was 5 or 6 years old.
What do you mean by playing around with it?
I would go and raid my parents' record cabinet searching for records that I wanted to hear, certain albums, because I wanted to see the colors.
Isn't that something? Did you think everyone did this?
By the time that I was about 6 or 7 years old, I was quite aware that other people didn't. My family was very musical, and we interacted with a lot of other musicians, and nobody else was talking about the colors, so
right.
I figured they didn't see the colors.
As we said, you see color also when you eat certain foods. Give us some examples. I say chicken, you say...
Chicken is sky blue.
How about the smells? I know it's just strong smells, but let's say, you know, gasoline when you're putting it in the car.
Gasoline would be a very dark purple.
Is this something that you like having, or is this a problem?
Well, okay, in general, it's something that I like, but my typical stock response to that is, okay, you've got a sense of smell, and
mm-hmm.
you can probably smell perfumes and fresh-baked cookies, and you've also probably smelled like a really filthy toilet and manure and things like that. Do you like having a sense of smell?
Yes, I wouldn't give it up.
Right. My synesthesia is just like any other. It is my sense.
Well, we understand that, by and large, synesthetes see their condition as positive. But you hear from parents whose kids show signs of synesthesia, and they don't know what it is.
I've encountered quite a lot of parents that get very worried. Parents who are convinced that their child is schizophrenic. I've also talked with teenage synesthetes themselves who are just wondering what's going on with them. It's not the case that that's every single teenager that I've encountered or every parent, but I've encountered some very frightening situations.
Such as?
One child who basically ran away from her parents after she was more or less locked in her room in her house for about 2 years because the parents didn't want her embarrassing the family with her talk about colored music, colored letters.
Huh. Well, and that's part of what's motivated your work with the American Synesthesia Association, to get information out. So let's do that. You've told us you see colors from sounds spatially, you know, as you've said, up in the sky or some down by your feet. You see different colors for different instruments. And when you were a kid, one of those records you listened to was Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite, which culminates in this thrilling storm.
Yeah.
We're just listening to a little now of Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite. This is before the thunderstorm.
Yeah, I haven't heard that in like about 15 years.
Really? What are you seeing?
Okay, hang on here a second. There was a flute there beforehand, and that was a very light sky blue color way on up at the top of my vision. It's a woodwind coming up again. It's very sky blue. This is all on a background of strings, and so way in the back there's sort of like a wood paneling of brown.
Wow. We're going to fast forward to the thunder, which is in the last movement.
Okay, timpani's way down low. Whole bunch of very dark blackish smoke. Low brass is sort of a reddish-orange flame. Visually, it's very much sort of like your image of the inferno or something like that. Just fire and smoke and very hellish.
Wow. Now, is this scary for you?
It used to scare the hell out of me when I was a little kid. I loved it.
That's Sean Day, a synesthete. Some of his senses are conflated, so when he hears music, he also sees colors. Same with smells and foods. They can also launch beautiful colors. And Sean, as we said, is president of the American Synesthesia Association. We also spoke with someone who knows Sean Day, Dr. Richard Sitowick. He's been researching synesthesia for decades. He recently co-authored the book Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia. Dr. Sitowick told us that researchers are now learning more about how synesthesia is expressed genetically, and the condition is not as rare as you might think. About 1 in 20 people has it. We asked Dr. Sitowick, why are there so many people walking around with this trait? Why do we keep this gene? Is there some benefit?
I think that this is a gene for creativity, that it helps make us smarter as a human race, because what the gene does is hyperconnect different areas of the brain. And the clue arises in the fact that synesthesia is more common in artistic people like Vladimir Nabokov and Billy Joel.
And what can that tell us?
In the past decade or so, it's forced a rethinking about how brains are organized and how non-synesthetic people perceive the world. The senses do not travel along five separate channels as we used to think. Indeed, the normal brain is incredibly cross-wired. Synesthesia highlights the astounding variety in which people perceive the world. And this gets to an old conundrum of how do I know that what I call red is what you call red? And the answer is we can't know, but it really doesn't matter so long as we both agree to call an apple red.
That's Dr. Richard Sitowick. He's been researching synesthesia for decades. He recently co-authored the book Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia.